Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Today, I want to talk about the things that have been on my mind about cardiac arrest. At SMAC in Berlin, I'm going to be hosting a panel of resuscitation doctors to talk about cardiac arrest. So I figured I'd do a little brain dump now and then cultivate from you folks the questions and thoughts you have so I can start building a really amazing panel to really grill these folks on the cutting edge of cardiac arrest management. So the first thing, and this is essentially an update to that lecture I did at SMAC Gold, that's up on the site and linked in the show notes to this episode at mcrit.org/191. But I basically, that was a brain dump as well. So this is what's developed since that talk. If you haven't seen it, it's probably worthwhile to watch that talk first, because I go into the basics of how I run arrests, and this is really or the icing on top of that cake. I don't know. I'm sorry for the analogy. Okay, let's go to it. The first thing I've been thinking about is the syndromic characterization of cardiac arrest. Right now, we're characterizing everything by rhythm. Are they VFib? Are they VTAC? Are they PA, asystole? And there's a huge value to that, because you will treat each of those differently. But there's also syndromes within those issues. And I think having that as a separate categorization could be really helpful and may lead us to some better therapies. So the syndromes of cardiac arrest. The first one is refractory VFib and VTAC, aka electrical storm. Very different management than just VFib and VTAC alone. And what should you do in these patients? Well, obviously, you optimize everything you can. You optimize compression quality. You optimize minimal perfect ventilation. But then you get to the specific stuff. After the ALPS trial, and you could read Rory's work on that on the site, antidysrhythmics took a hit, and probably a deserved one. But I'm not sure that evidence is applicable to electrical storm patients. And what do I mean by this? I mean the patients you've shocked like 8 times, and they're still VFib and VTAC. I think I would probably have a tendency to still administer antidysrhythmics. I've definitively seen it work with electrical storm with a pulse. So you get just persistent VTAC that won't shock out. And a combination of antidysrhythmics, even though that's usually verboten, has won the day in those patients. So I would probably give lidocaine. If the lidocaine didn't work, I'd probably give amiodarone. And that's where we sit now. We've given both of those meds. Maybe you've even repeated it, though I'm not sure how much benefit there is to that. But now what? Well, I think your next move is dual sequential defibrillation. And my friend Zach Shiner and my fellow ED ECMO brethren did an amazing session on this on MRAP, but you need to have an MRAP subscription. But if you do, just search for Zach's name and you'll find it. But what this allows you to do is not, as some may think, or at least not as I believe and Zach believes, that as some may think, that this is like doubling the electricity. That's not what it's all about. And if it was, you'd need to somehow perfectly time the two shocks, which even if you time the button pushes due to the internal circuitry, is not perfectly timing the shock. This needs to be done on the order of microseconds. But we don't think that's what it's all about. What we think it's about is vectors. It seems you need greater than 90%, Zach said greater than 95% of your myocardium depolarized at the same time in order to have a successful defibrillation. Now, if your pad location on the chest is not sufficient to get that percentage of the myocardium, you ain't going to shock out. Now, you could try augmenting by changing your pad position or increasing the effectiveness of the shock, and maybe it'll hit a few more by, you know, lowering chest impedance, getting the air out of the chest, pushing down on the pads. But an easier way to go may be just adding additional angles that the electricity flows through the heart. And you can do that by putting on a second defibrillator. I have a video from MRAP HD that demonstrates pad position. But for me, at the initial part of the arrest, we're going anterior-anterior. And then if we want to try this dual sequential, we put on another anterior pad in a different location and one posterior to it. And so now you get through the chest, you get across the chest, and hopefully you'll increase the percentage of myocardium that's done. And the way it's done is either you can put the machines next to each other and the same person pushes them at essentially the same time, which will lead to them being sequential because they'll never sync up perfectly. Or you have two people do it and you do 3-2-1 shock, and then you just got to make sure it's not a lethal weapon situation where do we shock on one? Do we shock on shock? None of you have seen the movie. You're all too young. Okay, so that's dual sequential defib, and I've had that work. And there's been case series demonstrating that works as well. Has there been a RCT? I don't know. I have to look for that. I didn't come across one. There might be. I don't think so, but there might be. Okay, what next? That didn't work. What now? Next for me is Esmolol. Esmolol, that makes no sense. That's crazy. Why would you give Esmolol to these patients? We're given Epi. This is the opposite of Epi. Why are we doing that? All right, here's the deal. First of all, Epi. I've mentioned this before, but it's worth belaboring. Epi, we want the alpha. We want the two forms of alpha that it hits, which phenylephrine won't. But if Epi was a pure alpha that hit those two subunits, gold. We don't want the beta. Beta's crap. Beta screws up the post-arrest situation. And beta may increase the automaticity of the heart enough that they won't shock out of VFib. So imagine this scenario. Patient was in VFib from a MI. And in the field, they did exactly as they're supposed to. They gave a ton of Epi every 3 to 5 minutes. And the patient didn't shock out with them. Now you got a patient who your CPR may be enough that the perfusion to the heart is sufficient to get the patient shocking, but their cells are in too much of an automaticity state from all that epi. Well, you come along and you just block the beta. You're not blocking any alpha. You're still getting all the putative vasoconstrictive benefits of the epi, but you're blocking the beta, and all of a sudden, bam, they shock out. We've had this happen just a couple weeks ago. We had one with my fellow, Atif, and it worked beautifully. I think this patient was shocked like 25 times, and then we gave the Esmolol. The dose, you'll never remember it, so just say to the nurses, give me the same dose you'd give to an SVT patient, which will be 500 micrograms per kilogram. You just push it IVP, and now all of a sudden, they're blocked. Now, you can start a drip. You can start it the same way as the SVT. Start at 50. You could even go up to 100, but I don't bother. If it didn't work and I wanted to try it again, I'd just give them another 500 microgram per kilogram bolus. But you're blocking the beta from the patient's intrinsic sympathetics, which I doubt really are operative any length into the code. But you're also blocking the exogenous epi that's been given and potentially taking a patient who would have otherwise shocked out, but the epi on board is preventing it. At least that's my idea. And I put the case series from Hennepin there, and take a look. I think you got little to lose because, again, they don't need the beta. Okay, next up, you could take them to the cath lab on mechanical CPR. It needs to be fluorocompatible, so that's the Lucas. I don't know about the Zoll device, if it is or isn't, and I know the Thumper's not. But if you have a Lucas on, you could take them up to the lab, and they could open up the lesion. Because at this point, into electrical storm, it almost certainly is a lesion. They could open up the lesion and then potentially shock the patient out of VFib. And then obviously, if they're a candidate, ECMO is the move for the syndrome of refractory VFib VTAC / electrical storm. Okay, so that's syndrome number one to think about. If you have any comments about that, put them in the show notes. Syndrome number two, profound intractable vasoplegia. What do I mean by this? Well, Norm Parody's work that I've discussed in previous podcasts, you can see them linked in the show notes, tells you that you need a coronary perfusion pressure of 15 millimeters mercury in order to get a patient to a shockable rhythm and let them shock out. That basically equates to a diastolic blood pressure of 35 to 40. Well, I just a lot see patients on my mechanical CPR with a systolic pressure of like 120 and a diastolic pressure of like 7. And they never shock out. They never go to a shockable rhythm. They just stay in arrest. And so my experiences confirm that study. They're not coming back to something you could shock them out of with a diastolic blood pressure of less than 10 or, you know, less than 35. So this vasoplegic state, it's a problem that needs remedy, and we don't talk about it much. These may be the patients that actually benefit from epinephrine. These may be the patients that benefit from high-dose epi. We know high-dose epi gets ROSC and not RONF, but that was in an unselected group of all cardiac arrests. Does high-dose epi work in the patient with an arterial line in? That's what we're talking about here. That's how I'm measuring this diastolic blood pressure, is a femoral art line. With a femoral art line who are demonstrating they can't get their diastolic blood pressure up with your standard code management, would they benefit from high-dose epi? Maybe. We've entered a zone where evidence does not live, so be aware of that. You know, but I think trying high-dose epi is worthwhile in these patients. I started trying methylene blue as well, which is a potent synergistic augmenter of vasoconstriction that I got experience with in the CTICU for post-pump vasoplegia. No one knows the exact dose in cardiac arrest, but I give the 2 mg/kg we're all familiar with for treating methemoglobinemia. Now, this drug at its higher doses in this like 5 to 7 mg/kg range could actually cause methemoglobinemia, so don't go that high. But 2 mg is the accepted dose for most treatments in critical care. Don't give it to patients on SSRI. It'll have MAO inhibitor effects and could cause a crisis, and we're back to Libby Zion, so don't do that. But 2 mg/kg gives a profound vasoconstrictive response that lasts for hours. And we've had a few patients who have had a marked increase in their diastolic blood pressure, and we've been able to get back. Now, be aware, as I keep saying, that's not evidence. You know, that's just anecdote. But at the stage in the code where you just can't get them back any other way and their diastolic blood pressure is super low, my personal belief is they're not coming back unless you figure out something real smart to do soon. So use your judgment. My belief is Reboa will be the real answer to this situation. You'll basically increase the afterload on the coronaries dramatically. You can start giving your epi through the internal ER Reboa catheters, internal lumens. You can give your epi Jim Manning style right to where you want it, so above the Reboa catheter. And I think this will be the win for increasing that diastolic blood pressure. No one's done the studies. The only thing we have right now is a letter to the editor. I might do these studies if I could find money to afford the catheters. They're expensive right now. Or someone smarter than me will do the study, and that'll be even better because I have no desires to do studies. I only do them when no one else is doing the study I want. By that same token, I think a win for vasoplegia may be the junctional tourniquet. I've never laid my hands on these, but what they do is they externally compress the aorta. If someone has these, write in the show notes whether you think it would be feasible to use this during CPR to increase the afterload on the coronaries. And write back even with even more alacrity if you could actually do this study, because I probably can't, but wow, if you could, I think it would be a win. Okay, last syndrome to discuss. It's part of PEA, but I don't use the term PEA without an additional notation. And so on an ED ECMO show, we coined the phrase, or we coined the words, PREM and PRESS. And PREM stands for pulseless rhythm echocardiographic motion, and PRESS is pulseless rhythm echocardiographic standstill. And these are incredibly different. If you show me a PRESS, I will treat it exactly like PA ACLS style, because A, I think that's fine, and B, I don't think it matters because usually those patients don't come back. But PREM, you throw in the echo and the heart is beating, they just can't generate a palpable pulse. And you know, if you have an A-line in, I think you'll actually find the pulse in these patients. But let's say the systolic is low such that you don't think it's going to maintain perfusion. You got to treat these guys in my mind a little bit differently. First of all, your mind should immediately click into the, this is a survivable patient mode, or at least this is a return to circulation patient because their heart's already beating. So what do you do differently? Well, you got to figure out why they're not able to generate a pulse. If it's because their IVC is empty and their LV is empty, then they probably need fluid or blood depending on the problem. And you should have identified that problem by now. But that's what they need. If their heart is just kind of beating but not strongly enough, then they need inotropy. And epi's fine for that, but probably not in the insane code doses. And in fact, I'd be more reluctant to give 1 mg of epi to a beating heart. I'd probably give smaller doses. I'd probably give half a cc at a time, 50 micrograms, and see what that did. I'd probably put on a background level of pure vasopressors like norepi. I know it's not pure, but it's for me. Like if you've listened to the previous end of year grab bag, you'll see why I call that the pure vasopressor. If the MAP is less than 65 to give that a nice milieu of perfusion. But I treat these PREM patients differently. Something else is going on. I can fix these guys as opposed to the dismal feeling I have in my head in the press. Okay, so those are the syndromes of cardiac arrest. What else to talk about? Monitoring. If you've listened to my prior shows, you know everyone has end-tidal. Everyone has echocardiographic assessment being done. Everyone has cerebral oximetry. Now, the data is not great enough here to really say what we should be doing with this information, but my friends Sam Parnia and Adam Singer have published articles demonstrating a prognostic prediction, and it's really tough to think your patient's going to do well if you can't get their cerebral ox up, because basically it's measuring a time-averaged feeling of what's going on in the brain, and if there's not oxygen going there, that's bad. So if anyone has further thoughts on what we could do with cerebral oximetry, put them in the show notes. The other thing that leads from cerebral oximetry is time zero prognostication. Now, this is one of the things I'm going to grill the panelists on. Is there anything that will tell us at the beginning of the arrest, or even in the midpoint of the arrest, whether the patient has zero chance of surviving and we should stop? This would be super helpful. It would help us with our ECMO decisions. It would help us with all sorts of stuff. And maybe the cerebral ox may be the answer. I know there was some work from my friend Dave Cedar out of Maine on BIS. And it seemed like if your BIS was like zero, no chance, but no one had the BIS of zero. That was the problem. So it didn't really help at all, even though it seemed helpful. And it was small numbers. It needed to be redone. But I want that. I want a time zero prognostication. You got to give me something to let me know if it's worth spending the hour, hour and a half, because we are finding out more and more you should run your codes longer and you'll have neurologically intact survivors. That mostly was inpatient data, but I think it's applicable. So, you know, devoting an hour and 20 minutes to every single code when they have zero chance, well, that's not so great. And of course, look, I understand the ultimate time zero prognostication. If you're 95 from a nursing home, regardless of your advanced directive status, your time zero prognostication is pretty poor. And if you add on dementia to that, then it's virtually zero. So we understand that, but we're talking like you have a 65-year-old in front of you, you know, baseline status good. How do you know? How do you know, even though they were down in the field for 40 minutes, if they weren't having intermittent undetectable ROSC and therefore still have a chance? I want to know. Help me out. Okay, next topic, blood gases during cardiac arrest. I think I've mentioned this before as well, but I'll just put some studies and articles there because I find it interesting. If you want to get a blood gas during cardiac arrest to know what's really going on with your patient's physiologic milieu, you get a VBG, not an ABG. The arterial side misrepresents it in the looking better way. It looks better than the patient really is. And so you'll see higher pHs, you'll see lower CO2. So you want to get a VBG. And that tells you how miserable they really are. And at the same time, obviously, send the good stuff like potassium and electrolytes, just so you know. Okay, brief mention, nurse-run codes. We've switched to this entirely. I think it's game-changing. We have a nurse who is the nurse leader for the code, and we have a doc who's the doc leader for the code. And the nurse leader's job is to be in charge of rhythm checks, be in charge of telling us when it's 30 seconds to a rhythm check. I'll tell you why in a moment. They call for the epi administration. We tell them every 5 minutes, just call for the epi. Don't ask me. Don't do anything. Once we get a femoral art line in, that changes. And I'll talk about, actually, I talked about that in the SMAC lecture, so you can listen there, how that changes. But the point is the nurses are running it all. And the other job of that nurse leader is she or he is the task handler, meaning anything I need an A-line setup. I don't have to find someone else in the room, call them by name as you're supposed to do in human factors and ask them to do it. I just need to know one nurse. I don't have to look around for all the others and just say, we need an A-line set up. And then that nurse assigns all the jobs. So now all of a sudden the doc leader can communicate with the nurse leader and the nurse leader communicates with the doc leader. The doc communicates with all the docs. The nurse leader communicates with all the nurses. And the entire code now has been, it's offloaded the cognitive burden on you as the doc leader to just think about the high-end stuff like, why is this patient in arrest? Is the compression quality good? Is the ventilation quality good? Is there something else that I could be augmenting? And then it allows the nurse leader to just look at the clock that he or she has in front of him or her, and therefore they could handle the time-based stuff. And it just works out so much better. And all of the nurses I spoke to love it. They feel like they have ownership of the code. So try that. This was first suggested by my friends Joe and Zach on the ED ECMO podcast. Okay, we got just a couple minutes left. Let's talk about the perishock pause. We are finding more and more that stopping compressions around the shock is the really deleterious thing. That, you know, stopping it during a PA or a systole, it's bad, but it's not nearly as bad as around a shockable V-fib rhythm. So you want to eliminate the pre-shock pause, the peri-shock pause, and the post-shock pause. So how do you do this? The pre-shock pause, the way to do this is if you have it, use look-through analysis. We put it underneath our Lucas piston, and all of a sudden, we could see what rhythm they're in, even though the compressions are still going on. Now, I don't trust it absolutely. It primes my brain for when I do the rhythm check to actually see, is it the same thing I saw during the look-through? And if it is, then it just takes a brief second, as opposed to having to stare at that thing because my mind hasn't been anticipating what it should look like. So now that's the pre-shock, and you guys know, gosh, I hope you know, in ACLS it even says this, no pulse checks. It's a rhythm check, and only if the rhythm is PA do you do a pulse check? If it's VFib, VTAC, or asystole, no pulse check, and that stops your pre-shock pause. It eliminates it as much as possible. Okay, so that's the pre. What about the during? Well, one thing to do is pre-charge your defibrillator. There's a fantastic article by my friend Sam Galley on this that is in the show notes. I've been doing this for years. And what this means is when the nurse leader says 30 seconds to a rhythm check, the defibrillator gets charged. And therefore, when we actually do our rhythm check and then we immediately start compressions again, we could shock instantly because the defib is already charged, because there's a chance while you're charging the defib, they're going to devolve out of their shockable rhythm. And then since I'm administering the shock during mechanical CPR, there is no pause at all for the shock itself, no hands-off time. Make sure you don't do that. If you are insistent on not using mechanical CPR, as many are, then actually you probably should do hands-on CPR with an offset, whether that's a towel or electrical gloves have been studied in the literature, or a pad or something, so that you don't have to stop compressions during the shock. And then the post, you know, is to not stop compressions immediately after the shock to look whether it was successful. You stop a minute after. Now, you could still know if they got ROSC during those compressions by a bump in your end tidal or the look-through analysis as mentioned. Okay, just briefly, I love mechanical CPR. I know there are mechanical CPR haters out there. The second there were articles demonstrating no harm, I was all in, because it just changes the entire complexion of the code. There is no evidence that it is better than hand CPR in terms of ROSC and RAMF. There is definitive evidence for anyone who's been in a code with a mechanical device to say that the room atmosphere is better. And that's worth the money to me. If that's not worth the money to you, then don't use it. But if you're going to use a mechanical CPR, the move should be to do it, the transfer of them from hand CPR to mechanical on the EMS stretcher. Now, all of our patients come in on a backboard or scoop. So the way this works is they continue their hand CPR. We actually make sure their monitor is all hooked up. This is the EMS monitor. We stop their CPR for a sec, do a rhythm check. If they're in a shockable rhythm, we start compressions again, we charge up, we shock either hands on or hands off. If they're not in a shockable rhythm, we're going to do the transfer now. I have a video in the show notes showing how to transfer a Lucas with the minimal amount of hands off time. Like 2 or 3 seconds is all you're losing. And since we've already made sure they're not in a shockable rhythm, you've taken out the main reason I think mechanical CPR may not turn out better, is you're losing the opportunity to shock if you put them right on the mechanical CPR, which you don't lose with the hands. There's hands off time, they lose their shock, etc. Okay, so now I got them on the EMS stretcher on mechanical CPR. Now I could just transfer the backboard over, and we don't have that long period of getting them from one stretcher to another, unstripping all the wires, blah, blah, blah. The hands off time is markedly less. So try that. Let me know what you think. Okay, well, last thing to talk about, and then we'll stop because I'm 4 minutes over now. Consciousness during CPR. I've gotten a lot of questions about this. I've seen it a bunch myself with mechanical CPR, strangely. I have never seen it with hand CPR unless the patient died right in front of me. But I see it all the time with even a recent code with mechanical CPR, is a patient fully awake, grabbing at the Lucas, and then you stop compressions for a sec to see if they have a pulse. Nope. They're in a pulseless rhythm, and you have to start again. And now you've had an unnecessary pause. So that's, you know, it's poor. And, you know, you could keep playing this game. They keep waking up during CPR, keep dying the second you stop. They put a letter to the editor in resuscitation, a guy named Nudell. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that name, with a protocol. And that protocol agrees with what I've been doing as well. They give 0.5 to 1 milligram of ketamine. That's what I do. I just give the 0.5. That's almost always enough. They say plus or minus a milligram IV of midazolam. Obviously, these could go IO as well, and that's their protocol. And you can repeat that if the patient wakes back up. Usually, they don't. You get like 30 or 40 minutes with that ketamine, and that's how I play these consciousness during CPR games. Okay, think we could stop there? I'd love to hear what you think. I'd love to hear any questions you have for the amazing panel, folks like Steve Bernard, Jim Manning, Sarah Gray. It's going to be kick ass. So put your questions in the show notes, mcrit.org/191. Scott Weingart, mcrit podcast, saying bye-bye.